Hello, welcome to this week's Boxing News podcast, The Opening Bell. I'm Editor Tristix and joined by Danny Flexen. Danny, how's it going?
It's going well. It was my 33rd birthday yesterday. I was feeling a little worse for it this morning, but I've just about come back to life now, so it's a good time to do the podcast.
Good, glad to hear it. It's been a bit of a roller coaster this week for one reason or another, taking the birthday out of the equation. Obviously, it started on a high with Kell Brook winning the world title over in Los Angeles on Saturday night, but then things definitely took a turn for the worst when our friend at Boxing Monthly, the editor Glenn Leach, passed away, which was dreadfully sad news felt by everyone here at Boxing News. Danny, if I can trouble you for just a couple of memories of Glenn, if that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first time I met Glenn properly was at a Matchroom barbecue. It might have been the first one they'd done a couple of years ago. And myself and Paul Beasley, who was the editor of Fighting Fit at the time, I was the assistant editor, we went there just to meet the fighters and so on. And Glenn ended up giving us a lift, purportedly gave us a lift back to the office. He actually gave us a lift quite far away from the office, and it took a lot longer than if we got the train. But it was well worth doing just because he's very knowledgeable about the sport and passionate, and he told us a lot about the publishing business that, you know, I certainly didn't know, and maybe Paul Beasley didn't either, I'm not sure. But just a very warm, lovely guy, always there to help. I've sought his advice over the years on numerous occasions since. We've talked a lot, you know, about boxing and about stuff outside the sport as well. And yeah, it was just a massive shock, and I'm not saying I was close to him, there's a lot of people out there, but I am really going to miss him.
Been a tremendous outpouring of grief and respect for Glenn, and rightly so. As I've sort of made it clear in different avenues over the last couple of days, what he's done, and to be an editor in the current climate for 22 years or so, has been it's a remarkable achievement, and it wouldn't surprise me if that is the end of the editors sort of in this spectrum that go on sort of 20 years plus, because it's incredibly difficult and very hard to maintain at that kind of level, having to deal with that kind of pressure on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. One of my memories from Glenn that I haven't shared yet so far actually is I remember when I first became the editor, he sent me an email, sort of just a congratulatory one. And you know, we sort of stayed in touch obviously quite regularly after that. But one thing that struck me about Glenn is obviously he'd been around the block by the time I became the editor. I've now been an editor 4 or 5 years, and he'd done, well, obviously 15 or so years by then. And what strikes me now looking back on it is that since then, sort of, he always addressed me as Brother Ed. And obviously that's because we were the two sort of boxing editors in this country. And what's unique about that really is that, you know, when you think of someone as a brother, you see them as on an equal footing. And certainly at the time, and definitely now, I don't see myself and Glenn being on an equal footing, because he'd been in the game so much longer. So to welcome me as he did, and then to refer to me as a brother, was, well, it's just something that you wouldn't imagine people doing. You know, it's not, Glenn always thought outside the box. He was very much a unique character, and that's probably one of the only ways that, you know, it's only he would have addressed people in that way. But still, it's one of my memories from Glenn, and as you say, and as so many people have said, it's a massive loss and a very sad one for everyone in boxing. Trying to get things slightly more upbeat now, if we can. Obviously, Kell Brook upset the odds. He did upset the odds to beat Sean Porter in America. Were you surprised at all?
No. I'd done some punditry work on Box Nation earlier in the evening for the Germany show, for our Arsland challenging Juan Pablo Hernandez. And we talked about Brook Porter on there, and I'd predicted a Brook win, either late stoppage or on points. I'm not just saying that to brag. I mean, that is part of the reason why I'm saying that. Honestly, but I'm saying it because pre-fight, I didn't write a preview, obviously. Far too busy. I fancied Brook. I just thought a lot of people were assuming that because of the Carson Jones struggle in their first fight with Brook, that he struggled to deal with pressure fighters, it would test his conditioning and his resilience. Yeah, that's true, it did. But I also thought that Brook's style was all wrong for Porter. because he was a very straight puncher and a very sharp puncher, and Porter did leave himself open as he came in. He's quite scrappy and quite raw for someone at that level. So yeah, I wasn't overly surprised. I think because it was such a close fight, I was maybe a little surprised Brook got the decision in America.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. Although the stats from the Fight Score Collector reveal that a very, very small percentage of people have Porter winning it anyway. But the margin of difference was different, or the margin on the scores was different across the board. How did you score it on the night?
I was kind of half asleep. It was about 5 o'clock in the morning. Obviously, I'd done the Box Nation gig earlier, so I was pretty knackered. But I felt it was very, very close. I mean, Brooks seemed to have the better of it in the second half. Porter, I wouldn't say he dominated the first half, but he seemed to win more rounds in the first half. Brooks didn't seem to be doing enough early on.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't have surprised me either way, to be honest. And it being in America as an influence as well, I kind of thought Porter would probably get it.
Yeah, it was the English judge, Dave Paris, that scored at 114 apiece. But yeah, the 117, 111 seemed too wide, but then I had it 116, 112 at the end on my card. So yeah, exactly. So it is only one round different. And, you know, as you know, the margins can be very, very slender when it comes down to some of these fights. Sakio Bika was upset by Anthony Durrell. For years we were talking about Andre Durrell being the main man in that family, but it's Anthony who's gone on and won the super middleweight title. What would you like to see Anthony Durrell do now?
Well, first of all, we just said that Anthony Durrell upset Sakio Bika. I think the fight generally upset a lot of people, including me, because it was rubbish. And it's probably one of the reasons I'm so tired by the time the report came around, because it was a foul-filled mess. But yeah, I'd like to see Anthony Durrell fight someone with a more aesthetically pleasing style, so we can have a really good fight. Who's out there at super middleweight for it?
Well, would you like Golovkin to go up and make... Golovkin's saying he's now going to fight Marco Antonio Rubio. Do you think that fight would be good for him to move up and fight Anthony Durrell?
Possibly, yeah, maybe to test the water at super middleweight rather than go straight in with a Cole Frotch or something.
Marquee
like that.
Name, yeah.
Yeah, I think that'd be interesting. But from Durrell's perspective as well, maybe a unification against an Abraham or someone like that rather than a Frotch or a Ward, I think would be interesting.
Okay. Omar Figueroa beat Daniel Estrada, and then Deontay Wilder beat Jason Gavin. Deontay Wilder is one of those guys, I mean, it looks like he's got the Bermejo-Severn fight next anyway, but he needed rounds. He got about four against Jason Gavin. He could do with sort of an 8-10 round fight before he goes into any title fight. Who would you put him in with? And we're treading into heroes and villains territory this week. No. Who would you put him in with to go rounds without getting him beaten?
I think some of the heroes and villains answers were pretty salient. I think, was it Paul Wheeler maybe, or someone said Derek Chisora?
Yeah.
I think it's probably a good shout. But there would be a risk of him getting beaten. We don't really know how good Wilder is, that's the problem. Well, it's his problem, it's not really our problem. But Chisora is good enough to beat a fringe-level fighter, and probably not quite good enough to beat an elite-level fighter. So he would tell us which Deontay Wilder is.
What do you think about Tony Thompson?
That would be interesting as well. I mean, Thompson's very awkward. Chisora's obviously got a good work rate, physical strength, you know, throws a lot of punches.
Not as big. No. Not as awkward.
Tony Thompson's big, he'll lean on you, he's a southpaw. All things that Wilder hasn't fought in abundance, so that would be interesting as well. He certainly would blast Thompson out there in a few rounds.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, it'd be interesting. Wilder, is he all hype?
It's so hard to say because of the level of opposition he's been fighting. He looks outstanding against those sort of guys, but even against overmatched opposition, you can pinpoint flaws that he has. So if you can see those against overmatched opposition, all that means is they're not good enough to take advantage of them. Put him in with someone who's, you know, a sharp puncher, who's clever, someone like Bermain Stiverne, for example.
Who can take a shot.
Who can take a shot as well, yeah. He could expose Wilder.
Okay. On the undercard over at Carson, there were straightforward wins for Callum Smith and Luke Campbell. Now, I've always been a supporter of the Brits going over there and fighting on these undercards, getting the experience and stuff, getting wrapped up in the big fight week and going through all the things, you know, meeting the stars and getting used to the big level surroundings that come with big fights in LA and Vegas and New York. But what's to be gained from sort of blasting someone out in front of an empty arena? Because this is one of the things, it always sounds glamorous that they're going to be fighting on such an undercard. I remember John Murray did a few, like maybe a Mayweather and some Hatton undercards a few years ago, but when push comes to shove and you're in the venue, there's no one else in there apart from basically the fighters. Is there anything that can be gained from that?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe not from the fight itself, but from everything surrounding it, some of the stuff you alluded to. going just for a start, going over to America and fighting over there with the time difference, dealing with jet lag is one thing. Fighting abroad generally, you know, finding where to train, finding a gym abroad, finding the right nutrition. When you're out of your comfort zone, you don't know, you know, it's unfamiliar surroundings, you don't know where everything is. The media week as well is important. You get to meet the US media, you get more exposure. You go to press conferences, you go to weigh-ins, and on smaller shows in the UK, there won't be as many media engagements as there are over there on a big fight week in the US. You know, by association with the main eventers, you get to meet a lot more people and also a lot more fans than you would otherwise. So everything else by the in-ring action is really, really valuable, I think, to guys like Smith and Campbell.
Okay, interesting. I have to agree with you. Cruiserweight, I'm out there now writing the Marco Hupp preview for next week. And you said, you were doing the Box Nation stuff here at Arsenal, Juan Pablo Hernandez. What happens now? Should Marco Hupp make a record-breaking defence of his title? What happens next? How would you like to see the Cruiserweight shake up?
I'd like to see Hupp fight Hernandez, yeah, I think a lot of people would. I think we complain so much that fighters who are with rival promoters don't fight each other, like Golden Boy and Top Rank and Matchroom and Frank Warren, for example. But there's two guys, they're both champions in the same division, they're both of the same promoter, but they're being kept apart. And I understand why from a business perspective, but it should be so easy to make. And I'd really like to see it. They've got contrasting styles, they're both impressive in their own ways, but they've both got flaws as well. I'd really like to see them.
Do you know what, they should do that and sign it with a rematch clause, and then they get two paydays out of it.
Yeah, it kind of gives them a safeguard, doesn't it?
Yeah. So, okay, interesting. It'd be nice to see Hernandez get a big fight, but he's one of those guys who's really sort of going under the radar, isn't he?
He's vulnerable, isn't he, as well? That's the thing. So if he doesn't get that big fight, you wonder with each, you know, what's supposed to be a straightforward defence and never is he going to get knocked off by someone? Is he going to get upset?
Well, of course, there was a general consensus, although Paul Wheatler accurately called it in his preview that it would be a close fight. There was a general consensus that he was going to be far too good for Fira Arslan, but that wasn't the case, was it?
No, I certainly thought, and we talked about this earlier, that Fira Arslan had kind of peaked with the first Marco Hupp fight. Although even in the rematch, although he got taken out in, I think it was the sixth round, he looked pretty good up to that point. It was still quite competitive. But Hernandez was quite lazy. He came out pretty fast. The first three rounds, he threw a lot of punches. But he seemed to gas from the fourth, fighting with his mouth open, getting backed onto the ropes and into corners a lot. And that's Arslan's game. He's a great inside fighter. And he produced a really good performance, lasted the course well. Was, you know, our reporter there said he was unlucky. I thought Hernandez probably just did enough, but it was a very close fight.
Okay, as we said later on the night, Special Kell Brook won the world title over in Carson. He said in an interview with us afterwards that he would rather fight Amir Khan than Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao. He wants the big British fight over here. A, do you think that fight will happen? And B, who do you match with in the interim, given that it looks like he's going to be fighting November, December time?
Okay, I think that fight could happen. I think it's very much dependent on whether Amir Khan gets the Floyd Mayweather fight next May. Assuming, of course, as I am, that Mayweather will beat Marcus Maidana in their rematch and Khan comes through whatever warm-up fight he has in November, December. I don't see Khan fighting Brook in November, December. I think it's too big a risk for Khan. He could lose that fight, and if he does, he'll never fight Mayweather. Hmm. It's just not worth it. You know, the Mayweather fight will make him an instant, well, he's already a millionaire, but it'll make him comfortable for life. You know, he'd never have to fight again, never have to work again. So who for Brook in November, December? I've seen some of the names bandied about, including Jose Zito Lopez, don't really want to see that. Keith Thurman is probably a bit of a big ask for a first defence. Maybe Devin Alexander, if they could get him over here.
Although he's in the running for Khan, isn't he? Alexander and Guerrero, yeah, seem to be in the running for Khan.
And for Brook, Guerrero apparently. So what's an easier fight to make?
Well, okay, how about this? Two names. I've spoken to Eddie Hearn about this, one before, one after. Before the fight, it seemed like he thinks if Brook won, get Leonard Bundu back, who's obviously been over here and beaten Lee Purdy and Frankie Gavin. Mm-hmm. Or he mentioned the other day Brandon Rios over here, which, you know, a guy who's made his name at lightweight.
I think Brandon Rios would be near perfect matchmaking. The problem with Bundu, he's quite well known over here now and he's a good fighter, he'll test Brook, but he's not that well known in America, and I think they want to capitalise on Brook's newfound fame in America after dethroning Porter. If they're going to do that, even if it's shown delayed because the fight will be here and the time difference, they'll want quite a marquee name,
yeah,
so that American TV pick it up. And Rios is. Rios always in exciting fights, but his style and the fact that he's not a natural welterweight makes him almost cannon fodder for Brook.
How would you not price it out, what kind of fight would you say percentage-wise it was? 70-30 Brook, 80-20?
70-30 I think is fair. You know, Rios can punch and he's strong, but can he punch at welterweight? Probably not. He takes a lot of shots, you know, his face is his defence. So.
Yeah, I mean, for Brook, moving further forwards, because Brook is with Matchroom, the door's wide open for him for these mega fights now, isn't it? I mean, obviously he says he wants the Khan fight, and that could well happen at Wembley Stadium next year. Eddie Hearn said that's the fight that he wants and that he's going to work towards. But because he's got no allegiance with Top Rank, HBO, Showtime and Golden Boy, Brooks, you know, everything's open to him.
Yeah, it is. You know, the world's his oyster kind of thing. And I think the Khan fight, yeah, it does depend a lot on Mayweather, but then would Eddie Hearn, having sold out Wembley Stadium, if he could, for that fight, would he be in a position to offer Khan more money than he'd get for being the B-side of a Mayweather promotion? It's hard to say. I mean, that usually is the biggest money fight out there for anyone, isn't it?
Well, I think the thing is, I mean, in terms of finances, I think Eddie Hearn has offered Khan $5 million before for the Brook fight. I think I'm right in saying that. If so, it's there or thereabouts. And Maidana, I think, made $1.5 million for the Mayweather fight. Now, obviously, I think there's been a sticking point with Khan and Mayweather's negotiations, because obviously Khan's not going to fight Mayweather for $1.5 million because he brings more commercial. There's more commercial sense in Khan fighting than Maidana fighting. You know, he's got the big Twitter following. He's got different followings around the world that he brings to the table. But at the same time, is he really going to top $5 million for fighting Mayweather? But Khan's always had this obsession, and it's not a bad obsession, but fighting to be a big name in America. And obviously fighting Kell Brook in Wembley Stadium is big over here, but that's not really what he's set his stall out to do. You know, he never fought John Murray or John Thaxton in the big lightweight fights over here. He's never fought like any of the top British guys over here, really. He's always looked to go further afield and take on people on the world scene, which you can't knock him for that. But what do you see him doing, or what do you think he'd rather do? Say the money was the same as it could be, Mayweather in the States or Brook over here in Wembley?
I think Mayweather. Because I think if he fights Brook first, he'll think he can win the fight, but if he does fight Brook first and he loses, the Mayweather fight's gone forever. And that's, you said he was obsessed with fighting in America and succeeding over there, but in the past few years he seems to be obsessed with that Mayweather fight specifically. And if it's something he really wants, why would he risk it? I can't see him fighting someone as good as Brook in the interim.
Okay. Who wins, Brook or Khan?
That's a tough one. I really don't want to sit on the fence, but I'm actually not sure. I've been a believer in Brook for such a long time, and he's finally achieved it, although I didn't think his performance was outstanding against Porter. It was enough to get the win. Khan doesn't fight often enough these days for my liking. He's got a style that relies on sharpness, and I think that shows when he's been out of the ring for a long time. Although he was excellent against Luis Collazo. Brook's been at welterweight for longer, that could be a key factor. If they fought right now, I think I'd probably just about go for Brook.
Stoppage?
Leg stoppage, yeah.
Okay, interesting.
Who would you go for? Get away with that.
Damn it. Yeah, I think I've always favoured Brook, and I think a lot of it does come down to punch power and punch resistance for me. I think Brook has got the style and the sort of snappiness to catch Khan coming in and get him in trouble. And you know, although Khan did it really well against Collazo, he's obviously done it well in the past against Kotelnik when he's boxed to a plan. Too often he's been drawn in, and I wonder in a fight with Kell Brook, where there's clearly some needle, some personal feelings, if he wouldn't get drawn in at some stage and try and do something that because it comes obviously clearly comes very naturally to Khan trying to get involved in a tear up, and I think he would in at some stage stand and trade with Brook, and I think that would be it. I think he'd get hurt and he'd be stopped. But at the same time, obviously, if Khan can stick to a game plan, he's proved that he can pretty much outscore anyone in the world.
Yeah.
We do have a great feature in this week's issue by Elliot Wurzel on Adrian Broner. Basically, it's an interesting look at a very divisive figure. What I've noticed in America, and it's something that you can't escape, is when Golden Boy and Richard Schaefer, when he was with them at the time, when they sort of put all their fighters out on the stages and introduce them all. There's sort of some, there's some polite round of applause, and some of the guys with their own following, like Luis Santa Cruz, Leonardo Santa Cruz, they sort of have their ripples of applause and cheers. But when Broner comes out, the boos are deafening. And it's astonishing that someone, you know, there's different names up on that stage. You think Andre Ward, you even think of Bernard Hopkins. They don't evoke that much passion in people cheering for them, yet Broner unites people in booing for him. And it seems like people are very, very curious to see what happens with him. A lot of people want to see him lose. Obviously, I think people are dining out on the Maidana loss still now, even to this day. What's your take on Broner, and is he good or bad for the sport?
I think he's good for the sport. I don't think he's great for the sport's reputation in certain quarters, but as I said, I think in Heroes and Villains, boxing is not a sport that's always been built on, you know, fair play and good behaviour. Boxing is a man's sport. It comes from the working classes. There's always going to be controversial things going on. There always has been in the history of the sport. Broner obviously takes it to another level, and he's more of an immature child than an actual villain, I think. But he's good for the sport because he gets people talking. He gets people who wouldn't normally watch boxing to watch the sport. There's no better thing than that, in my opinion, because boxing is an increasingly marginalised sport. If we want it to become more mainstream, which, you know, it's in our interest as boxing news writers and editors, respectively, to do that, then Broner's a godsend for us, just as Tyson Fury is in Britain. You know.
You were a big Naz fan. Do you think Broner's good the same way Naz was good for people? Is that what you see, that kind of controversial link?
To an extent. The main difference is that Broner gets a lot of publicity for the things he does outside the ring, often negative things, whereas Naz was actually quite engaging. He was quite witty. You could put him on a talk show. Whereas Broner, I've interviewed him before, or tried to, and I know other people have. He's not the greatest talker. He's not the most engaging or charismatic personality. He's just a bit of an immature child, but that in itself creates a lot of interest.
Yeah, okay. So we've got Elliot's big feature on Broner in there. We've also got exclusives with Kell Brook, and a fascinating insight from Gary Hyde about the situation with Rugondo when John Dennon spoke to the Irish manager. Bob Mee was ringside for us in Carson for the Kell Brook Sean Porter show. One thing I will say about that Carson Jones fight is obviously Kell rectified things in the second fight, but there was so much going into that first fight against, you know, that Kell had, you know, so many issues going in. It obviously wasn't the real Kell Brook fight. But it's those kind of experiences that you need when you have those fights with the likes of Sean Porter. They all sort of tick boxes as you go along, don't they?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, that could easily have been a defeat.
Yeah.
You know, he was banging trouble, as we like to say in the office. And he fought through it, and he showed great tenacity. You know, he really proved his mettle in that fight. And it was also a kick up the backside that he probably needed in terms of his preparations. You know, if he hadn't come so close to losing, he might still be having some of the bad habits that he had back then now. So, you know, his victory over Porter, in large part, you can thank Carson Jones, or he should, who's just retired.
Yeah. The right crisis is the perfect crisis, isn't it? I mean, Ricky Hatton Ricky Hatton's the sort of blueprint, isn't he? He's a guy who's sort of been, I don't know, he's in fights where guys got disqualified, he was cut, he had his nose broken, he'd been behind on points and pulled out wins. He
put
sort
down
of
down in the first round.
Yeah, there were so many sort of boxes he ticked on the way to that Costa Zoo fight that, you know, there wasn't almost anything that he hadn't experienced by the time he got there to the world title fight.
He was kind of managed and steered and promoted absolutely fantastically, I think we'd have to say in hindsight. You know, for the majority of his apprenticeship, he fought all the different styles. He fought guys that would test him and teach him, but not guys who could beat him. Just like the perfect blueprint for how to bring a prospect through, I guess.
Well, it was all done under the auspices of the WBU as well, which. You know, obviously, a lot of people hated it at the time, and obviously, it's still not a particularly fondly recalled time. But like you said, he served an awesome apprenticeship under there. Which, had he been kicking on for the other world titles and had to be moved any faster, he wouldn't have served that kind of apprenticeship.
No, I mean, the whole way up it worked. Even the Costa Zoo fight was the perfect opponent at the perfect time. Zoo was just slightly over the hill, you know, just slightly past his peak, and Hatton was just peaking, so it was the perfect, you know, perfect challenge.
They do say it's in the timing.
Oh, yeah.
So, and interestingly, actually, this week, Anthony Joshua has been over sparring with Vladimir Klitschko, just been speaking to Bernd Bonte, actually, who phoned to express his sadness at hearing the news of Glenn Leach. And he said that Anthony had been doing very well in their first spar, and that him and Vladimir are getting on well. Are those heavyweights, those super heavyweight juggernauts from 1996 and 2012 respectively, are they too far apart to ever realistically meet in the ring?
It depends how long Vlad wants to go on for. I mean, they're talking about Joshua maybe fighting for world title, what, 2-3 years? So, yeah, I mean, it's not beyond the realms of possibility. And you've got to think that's why Vlad's got him over there as well, that he sees that this could be a potential future challenger, in the same way he brought Deontay Wilder over a year or two ago.
Tyson Fury a couple of years before that.
Yeah, well, Fury never sparred him, but he was in the same gym. And, you know, they kind of size them up, Klitschko and his team, and decide what potential's there, and then they can think about whether they want to fight him in the future. If so, they'll know their weaknesses, or whether they want to avoid them.
Okay. I think the closing word might have to go to Daniel Dawson, who's got the last word in the magazine this week, the Australian who's going over to America to fight Austin Trout. And I did have to... We asked in the 60-second question something not many people know about you, but did you know that Daniel Dawson has a pet budgie who follows him around and acts like a dog?
No, I didn't. Okay. In what way does the budgie act like a dog? Does he elaborate? I mean,
he doesn't. He doesn't. I'm guessing it's to do with the whole following thing, not unless he throws at balls and that kind of stuff. But still, Danny, thank you very much for joining us this week.
You're welcome.
Much appreciated. Yeah. You may stay at Boxing News.
Oh, thank God, another week.
Oh dear. But yeah, thanks guys for joining us. And I will leave just on a slightly somber note and just say once again reiterate the fact that we will all miss Glyn Leach moving forwards. And we hope that in our jobs as boxing news journalists and as boxing journalists full stop, we can go on and continue with the legacy that Glyn has left behind. Thanks for listening, guys.